Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. And welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Mary Fraser, author of the book Policing the Home Front, 1914 to 1918, The Control of the British Population at War. Mary, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Right. Well, I'm a social historian. I've looked at the history of nursing and the work of the nurse in a historical context. And for the last 10 years, I've been looking at the work of the police in a historical context, which I found most enjoyable. I have had an academic career, and I still do short courses, particularly on this aspect of the work of the police, at my local university, Glasgow University. And I enjoy working almost on a daily basis on developing this area.
What led you to focus specifically on the role of the police in the First World War, as opposed to, say, some other aspect of the history of the police?
Right. Well, because this was my first attempt at looking at the police, police work, I thought it would be better to confine it to something like period in time. And it seemed to me, because at the time it was the centenary of the First World War, that it would be a good idea to start with that. So it was really serendipity why I chose that, but I needed this confined period of time to make it manageable. And, you know, I found that work at that time was particularly challenging for the police, and therefore I found it a fascinating aspect, because a lot of the work that the police did was not what you might expect them to do. They had a whole load of other roles put on them, which were far from what one might consider policing.
Yeah, it's one of the things I found so fascinating about reading your book was just discovering the role that they played, not just in terms of policing British society, their, you know, sort of this traditional function that they serve, but as you explain, they were given all these additional duties at a time which, as you elaborate, the force is really coming under enormous strain.
Indeed, yes. Yes, because, you know, the police by definition were young, fit men, and so therefore many of them were conscripted into the army or navy, and you see many police forces losing, well, thousands. I mean, the Metropolitan Police in the first day that war was declared lost over 1,000 men. So, you know, this was a huge amount to lose at one stroke. And then because volunteering in the early days was thought to be glamorous, a lot of men left voluntarily for the war effort. And it was only in about the next 6 months that they realized what the war was about. And volunteering stopped in quite such large numbers. But by that time, I mean, out of Glasgow police, for example, with an establishment of 2,000, they'd lost 700. So this was a huge amount. But they were given permission to recruit special constables. But the special constables were part-time. They mainly had their own businesses to run, so they usually worked no more than, say, 4 or 8 hours a week. So they were sort of, some of the policemen less favourably called them just filling gaps rather than actually doing, you know, regular police work like someone employed only in the police service would do. But they did make up the numbers and they were put on beat on the streets so that, you know, they were visible to the population.
What you just described gets to a part about your book that I really appreciated, which is that you capture the attitude of the police themselves. I think about how many histories of the state and of policing so often treat the police as sort of this body of limbs, shall we say, where they go out and do things and don't have any sort of views of their own. And yet you work quite diligently to try to capture their voices. How did you do that?
Well, I found it interesting looking at their police journal. Now, this was the main journal that the policemen on the beat read at that time, and it was widely circulated. And it started in the 1890s by a man who wanted to improve the lot of the police. You know, he wanted to improve their education. He wanted it to be policing to be seen as a profession and to give them self-respect. It certainly did that. And the widely read journal allowed the police to have a voice. And so this is why this book is rather different. Some of the other police books I've read have been, as you say, you know, who the police were, you know, their ages, their backgrounds, where they were born, this sort of thing. Other police histories have been the history of the institution, you know, whether they were within local authorities and how that developed over time. But this book does very much look at the voice of the policeman on the beat and shows his worries and his frustrations and his struggles to actually do the job and to have a voice to be able to speak about his concerns and get answers that he trusts.
And that was a part of I was really impressed by how much of your book you devoted to that, because it really helped, I thought, to explain what life was like for the policemen during the war. And you already have mentioned one aspect of this, which was how many of them went off and served and how they had to work through a lot of these special constables.
Mm.
Also, I was wondering if you could, was that the only group of people that they turned to in these extraordinary circumstances to try to fill the ranks and continue to perform their various roles? Or were there other groups in society who had been underutilized, who they hadn't turned to until now?
Ah, right. Do you mean to actually recruit into the police force?
Yes.
Right. Well, certainly the tribunals, but this wasn't set up till early 1917. The tribunals, if they gave exemptions to men from going to war, they would say on condition that you join the special constables. Mm-hmm. There were also, uncharitably, men who enlisted in the police service because they didn't want to go to war. And they were considered shirkers and slackers. And they were said to be temporary policemen and sometimes boasted to the others that they were only there until the war ended. And of course, they were hated by the other policemen because they were felt not to really have the, you know, the fully ethos of the service, you know, at their command. So generally there were, and the women police were recruited, and they were very keen to perform police duties, but they were never really part of the police force. They were always separate from the police force and really only seen to be dealing with women and children. They weren't given authority to arrest anybody, and their work was really either patrolling the streets or working with women and children in the homes.
And yet, as you explain, that was actually a much larger role than it had previously been, because you have women more prominently in workforce now. Women are going out and socializing more. They're going into pubs more. Mm. So there was, as you explained, I thought this was really fascinating how you know, in effect, that creates a need for women police that hadn't been perceived as necessary until then, and how you begin to see more of them going from just those roles as matrons taking care of the women who were brought into the stations and jailed to where they're actually now playing a role in the enforcement of law.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. And they were either mainly involved with going to the homes when children were seen to be committing crimes and, you know, advising the parents and helping the children. But also one of their main roles was in trying to undermine the role of sexual immorality. And this was a huge problem. I mean, this was a moral panic in the First World War with the overseas troops coming and actually living in Britain, particularly the Canadian troops. You know, 40,000 of them came over and lived in Folkestone and went across to France to fight and then came back for their vacations. But, you know, the women police were seen to be patrolling the streets to in London, to be going to the public parks and seeing that immorality wasn't occurring. And the Dominions were really worried about the fear of the spread of venereal disease, and that was really their main concern. They were worried that at the demobilization at the end of the war, the disease was going to be carried back to their nations and infect their populations for as long as they could see, because there was no cure at that time. So it was a real worry for the Dominions, and particularly Robert Borden, the Prime Minister of Canada, was absolutely outraged by the fact that, you know, the Canadian soldiers could well go home with this sort of disease. So, you know, the police were there, particularly the women police, trying to put surveillance on the women. It was usually the women that were thought to be spreading the disease rather than it being, you know, by both genders, trying to prevent the women from actually having, you know, undertaking solicitation and, preventing them from hanging on to the men when they saw them in the streets, because some of the men were complaining to their prime ministers at home that they actually couldn't shake the women off. You know, and it was seen that the women police were the only group that could really deal with this. I mean, this was not seen as a male policeman's role. They felt completely unable to deal with it.
Was the class origins of the police a factor in this? Because you describe in your first chapter how most of the police prior to the war came from the working classes, and you explain that the women that were recruited into the police forces came from the middle classes.
Yes, absolutely. Because of the moral values that were associated, they were seen as the most appropriate people. And they were really keen to do the work. They really wanted to, and they continued to persist with their requests to be involved in various areas.
I thought the notion of the police as symbols of respectability was really fascinating. And you talk about it in this context of the police as these moral enforcers, but you also talk about it in a very different context, which I thought was even more interesting, which was this notion of living costs. How you explained that one of the expectations of the wives of police officers was that they could not go out and work. It was a notion of respectability. And you explained how that came under increasing strain as the war went on and you had this problem with wartime inflation.
Yes, absolutely. Because the increasing price of food, it was mainly the inflation in food prices. And the increasing inflation in food prices, I mean, food prices were, I think, in 1918, about 108% compared with 1914 when the war started. And then there were the shortages and of various items, and the whole of the diet changed. But whereas women who weren't associated with the police force were were able to go and work in munitions factories and things like that to bring in finance to the family. The women of the police officers weren't allowed to do that because they were seen to be, you know, apart from the community and support their husband's role. And there was certainly one woman that I came across who insisted on continuing with her role in teaching, and her husband never did get promotion. Because it was thought that, you know, she shouldn't be doing this. She should be devoting her time to her husband and family, the police family. And in fact, the journal that I took this material from very much supported the women. They gave them a forum for discussion. The wives' column was very prominent in issuing, you know, advice to women and providing even recipes when food became short of how to feed the family.
Did women have any sort of alternative or a way of bringing in income, or did they have a way of pushing back against the inflation by pressuring politicians to increase policemen's salaries?
They did, and they wrote letters frequently to the press, to the authorities, to the police authorities, saying that particularly if they had five children, and in fact, the police really were not keen on these large families because they realized that the police pay was going to be difficult to support five children. So they would prefer smaller families. However, the women constantly were asked through the journal to put down the costs of what they were spending on a weekly basis. And the police themselves or the wives then approached the police authority and said, look, you know, we simply can't manage on this amount of money. We are, you know, having to forego meat rations, and meat rations were seen in those times as actually giving the strength to the individual. The muscle strength. So without meat, you know, you'd have less strength, and that would affect the policeman's work on the beat, as well as the woman having to go without so that she could give her husband the meat ration for the week. So times were really difficult. And eventually, as it got to 1918, the food restrictions got so bad that there were recipes printed which were using cattle feed, mangels, to feed the family because of the lack of alternatives.
You also have another way in which the families addressed this, and this was an aspect of this other role that policemen were called upon to serve. And it's something that I had never heard about until I read your book, which was how they were called upon as the war went on to go and work on farms, not as police officers, but as laborers. It just struck me as this, as this way that officials thought of policemen as basically this exploitable workforce that they could just, you know, ask to do whatever was necessary.
Well, this is my current project, and I'm just developing this. And yes, it is an amazing area. I was amazed when I saw this. And it's because of their backgrounds. I mean, a third of the Glasgow police force that remained at home had agricultural backgrounds. And so you see about 154 of them were previous farm laborers, seven of them were previous ploughmen, and all sorts of agricultural roles. So in fact, they were absolutely ideal to go back to the land. And in the crisis of sudden food shortages at the beginning of 1917, every avenue was explored to get men to go and work on the land. And of course, they were mainly at that time, they would have used manual ploughs with horses. So of course, you needed a big beefy man to actually be able to hold the blades of the plough in the ground and to have the knowledge to direct the horses to make any impact on the land. And of course, at this time, it was March, so the land was damp, and it would have been really heavy to turn. So the policeman's physique and his knowledge of farming would have been absolutely ideal. And yes, there were eight locations in Scotland and eight locations in England that released policemen. So in Scotland, there were about 230 policemen released and about the same number in England to plough the fields. And they were released on a temporary basis, you know, for about 6 weeks. that the crisis was there. And the thing was that if the land wasn't ploughed before the end of April, this was giving a six-week gap to plough the land. If it wasn't ploughed and planted before the end of April, then there were going to be no crops at the end in August in the harvest. So this was why it was so crucial for them to actually be mobilized and go back to the land.
Now, were they asked to do this, or were they basically required to do it? Were they simply ordered it, or did they have any sort of choice in the matter?
No, they were asked, and the chief constable was asked by the corporation to identify those individuals that might want to volunteer, and he invited them to volunteer, and they did. Hmm. In large numbers. And I think from what I'm seeing now, I think that it was possibly one more way that it would be attractive to them was that it would be more important than working in the police force to avoid being conscripted into the army. Hmm. Because food production was a top priority at that point, more important than working in the police force.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
It really does underscore how vital the police were to the British state during the First World War. And I'm thinking here about how this is on top of all these other expanded duties that they've been given. One of the first ones that you address is this question of separation allowances. I was wondering if you could perhaps explain what these separation allowances were and what was the role of the police in terms of their distribution to families.
Right. Well, the separation allowance was the first big controversy of the war. And it was announced by the Asquith government in a week after war commenced. And the Liberal government, of which Asquith was the head at that time, had the notion of volunteering being important. They didn't want to insist that men went to war. So conscription was far from their agenda at that time. And in order to volunteer, to encourage men to volunteer, they said that they would look after their wives and families while the men were away fighting, so that the men wouldn't worry about the woman being unable to feed the family or running up huge bills. So the amounts were set, and they were quite low. They were only about the level of a farm labourer, so they weren't extravagant by any means, but they were issued to every wife. But then there was a condition that it was provided the wife hadn't committed a crime or given any sort of false information. And that was where the problem started to arise, because the controversy over women drinking and spending their money on drink and immoral living was one of the reasons that the police were brought in, to be sure that the money was being spent in an appropriate manner. And so there was huge controversy when the government issued, this was from the Home Office, the government issued a notice to all chief constables asking them to put surveillance on all wives whose husbands had gone to war. And of course, this created a huge controversy. And it was brought about by Arthur Henderson, who was the leader of the Labour Party. And he continued to insist in government, that in the House of Commons, that this was quite unreasonable and quite unfair, and women didn't need this. And then, of course, the women's labour organisations got involved and insisted that no, they were quite insulted by being accused of spending their money inappropriately. And how dare the government say that they needed surrogate husbands in the police force to control their spending? But this was the nature of patriarchy at the time. It was considered that women couldn't manage on their own.
That is something that really comes across well.
So this went on.
I was going to say, that really comes across in your book, which is this notion of the police as surrogate patriarchy, as surrogate fathers, not just in terms of separation allowances, but I was thinking in terms of how they dealt with the increased incidence of women consuming alcohol, youth crime, with all these men who were being first recruited and then conscripted going off to the front. Is this attitude that, well, the Bobbies will fill the void and that they will be the male authority figure that's ensuring that the patriarchal model is maintained.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yes, they did. And, you know, despite the fact that the women protested, they were often just swept aside. You know, even deputations of middle-class women were just swept aside. Government really didn't pay any attention to their concerns. So unless they were forced into it, you know, the police did receive the names of the women under who were in receipt of the separation allowance, and they did routinely kept drunken disorderly returns. This was part of the police annual report. And so merely adding a column which said, this woman is in receipt of the separation allowance, meant that the whole system could be monitored on a national level. Because each police force can, you know, wrote an annual report, including those sorts of statistics. And questions were asked in Parliament about, had any women lost their separation allowances? And yes, they had. Up until 1917, I think the number was over 2,000 had lost their separation allowances. So the police were very much determined and had really felt that the women should be sanctioned for acting in a drunken, disorderly fashion if it was in public and if it involved their children being neglected.
I was thinking about that as well when you are talking about the problem of alcohol abuse during the war, because you describe how there was at the same time this policing of the consumption or purchase of alcohol by women, and how this ended up pushing women into pubs. And so in effect, it seemed to be the message that came out of it was that the state didn't want these women to drink, and yet whenever they tried to restrict the activity in one respect, these women who were oftentimes on their own, they were now working. Sometimes they're working in factories. They wanted a release, and they would simply find another means to find it, even though the state was frowning upon it as not womanly activity.
Well, this was one of the issues in the war, that because a workforce was needed in a whole load of different areas that had never been used to having women before, that the women were emancipated. You know, they did go into pubs and drink on their own. And this was seen as shocking by the middle classes. They did work away from home in the munitions factories, and particularly if they were young girls, they were seen to need supervision in the hostels. And all these areas where women suddenly became involved in public, whereas before they'd been more in sort of in the private domain of the home. And this was what shocked the population, and the police were brought in to try and control this. And the women police, as one example of trying to moralize with the women so that they continued to work, but they didn't have the opportunity to either neglect their homes and families if they were married women with children, or to be involved in sexual immorality if they were single girls.
Was the problem of alcohol abuse confined just to women, though, or were they finding also, were there additional problems with, say, drunken soldiers who were home on leave?
Yes, 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 absolutely. Drunkenness was rife. And consumption, of course, rose with the increased prosperity of the nation, because almost everybody was working. So they could afford spirits rather than beer, although the working class drink was beer. But yes, in order to confine the level of consumption, the hours of opening of the pubs were considerably constrained. And the Alcohol Control Board even took over the running of the pubs and the breweries in Carlisle around the Carlisle area. And if you go to Carlisle, you can still see notices on the buildings saying this was a state-owned pub. And this was in an attempt to try and control the drinking behavior of the population, but also to try and set up things like works canteens in the munitions factories so that people had a chance to eat and not have to go hungry or bring their own sandwiches in, which often they didn't, during the working day. And this would prevent them from needing to use alcohol during the day, which they would bring in a hip flask to try and counteract hunger. So it was positive as well as negative in the way in which drink was controlled. But the controller of the Central Control Board, the executive of the Central Control Board, really relied on the police and encouraged the police to be active and involved in seeking out drunkenness. And it prevented him from recruiting a huge workforce himself, that he could rely on the police and encourage the police to do the work for the Central Control Board.
Another aspect of social morality that the police were heavily involved in was prostitution. You've already talked about it in other contexts. I was wondering if you could focus upon it a bit more. How did prostitution change during the war, and how did the police go about adapting and responding to these changes?
Ah, right. Yes. Well, prostitution was always a problem. And to start with khaki fever, which was seen as at the outset of war, with the young girls and probably young married women as well, congregating around the military camps, which were set up in large conurbations in different places, in the hope of, either seeing or cornering a man in khaki, which was seen as immensely attractive. And then the government felt that it really should have some sort of restriction on this. So part of the Defence of the Realm Act was to move the women on. They weren't allowed to congregate around the camps. But what this did when the prostitutes were sent elsewhere, and also the houses of immorality were closed, that they merely went a short distance away, and the troops tended to follow them on their bicycles. So, you know, it was very difficult to control immorality in the first instance. But increasing roles that constrained the prostitutes in particular meant that it was more the amateur girls who were not prostitutes and weren't necessarily receiving money for sexual gratification or sexual favors. They were the ones who were more of a problem to the police, because the prostitutes had already been convicted. So the police knew who they were and could, you know, follow them and could, you know, lock them up if necessary or warn them. But the amateur girls, they didn't really know who was involved in sexual activity and who wasn't. And in the private domain of sexual activity, the police said they had to observe somebody for a long time if they were soliciting to be sure that they could bring a conviction. And of course, if they brought a conviction and it was a wrong conviction, the police were said to be, you know, ruffians, uniformed ruffians, exploiting women and giving them an unnecessary sentence or an unnecessary court appearance. In the meantime, if the women were accused, they were taken to the doctors, who physically examined them to find out whether they had sexual intercourse. So this was, again, infringement of personal liberty if they were found to be innocent. So this made a huge problem for the police, because they were seen to really want to protect their image and not be accused of being uniformed ruffians, which was spread throughout the press. The police commit another blunder, sort of press reports.
Was there a class dimension to this as well, where the amateur girls tended to be not quite working class, they tended to be higher up, and so therefore there was this notion of social respectability that the people who were accused might be very determined to defend?
Yes, yes, some of them were. I mean, I think they were from all classes. Some were from the working classes. Some were from the more middle classes. It seemed to be absolutely rife in the war, and it was put down again to lack of male control, to the anxiety of the war creating these sorts of tensions within the women, and the same for youth crime. You know, it was considered that the excitement of the war would create increased immorality and increased law breaking.
I was thinking that especially comes out when you're talking about the issue of youth crime, which, as you explained, mm-hmm. was this serious concern for the police during the war. How did they respond to it, especially given the absence of so many fathers?
Right. You mean the police? How did the police respond to it?
Yes. Did they? I mean, obviously, they're dealing with this increase in it. Did they try to assume more of the parental role, or did they simply try to put more pressure upon the families to step up and do more on their end?
Well, they did try to impose middle-class moral values on the families, because if the child was taken to court, they would then want background information on the family. And this was where the women police came in, that they went into the family circumstances. They'd see how the family lived. They'd probably assess their income level. They'd see how many other children they had, what sort of neighborhood they lived in. So they create a complete profile of the family. But also they would follow this up later on to be sure that the message got across of how moral values were to be built up. Like, for example, instead of having the youth having temporary jobs which were of little value, trying to get them permanent jobs which actually built to a scene where they would eventually get married and be breadwinners for the family. So they would have these middle-class values rather than, you know, being what people were worried about is the degradation of the nation. That you had large numbers of youth who actually had very few skills and were never going to be able to be earning enough to keep a family.
I thought this concern about degradation was especially stark when you're talking about this question of regulating the cinemas. Because and here was something that you're talking about a relatively new medium, one that is really coming into its own. And yet you have that discussion of morality. What was the primary concern about the cinemas, and what role were the police playing in terms of addressing it?
Well, the cinemas at that time had two ways of being controlled: what was shown in the cinema and also the building itself. I mean, the laws first came in about the cinema to protect them from fire because of the celluloid films going, you know, catching fire. So that was the first concern, and that was before the war broke out. But once the war broke out, there was worry about the content of the films being shown, whether it was either immoral or whether it would increase give the youth ideas of ways of committing crime, housebreaking, shopbreaking, that sort of thing. And the local authorities had responsibility for giving licenses to the films. But there was no central control of this. And so if one local authority banned one film and the other local authority next door didn't, the people merely travelled to the next local authority if they wanted to see the film without any sort of regulation. And what the police did was to, again, have some sort of sense of moral values of what was a suitable film, particularly for children and adolescents to see. And when it came to the commission on the cinema, the police were brought in to give their views on two or three films which were said to be controversial. And where they said that the law wasn't sufficient to allow them to ban the films, they actually said that they wouldn't want their own daughters going to see it. So it showed you the difference and the ways in which the laws were really insufficient to be able to cope with what was largely felt to be immoral. Also, the women police would visit cinemas from time to time to be sure that at that time, before the commission report was published, the cinema lighting was very low, and there was worry that the children and the adolescents were being molested in the auditoriums. And the women police went in to, you know, have some sort of view on whether this was happening and to what extent. They weren't present in the auditoriums the whole time, so the potential was that it could occur. And again, it was said to be lack of parental control that, you know, the mothers didn't go to the cinemas with the children. They were allowed to go on their own. And who knows what they were going to see was the worry. One of the interesting outcomes of the commission on the cinema was that lighting in the auditoriums was increased. So you now got the dim lights in the auditoriums so that the chances of people being molested was less likely. And I found that quite interesting. I'd never realized that it wouldn't have been there all along. But the cinema had increased in such a dramatic extent and provided cheap entertainment for the masses. This was the problem. And the middle classes felt, because it had expanded at such a rapid rate and because it was so cheap that everybody could go and see it, and the middle classes were worried about how it was going to influence working class attitudes. And they felt out of control. I mean, this was really the basis of it.
So what you've described in this book basically is how the police are playing these two roles. One, they're serving as these exemplars of morality and patriarchal stability, and they're also playing this role as enforcers of those things. And yet you have, near the end of the war, this fascinating moment where the police go out on strike, which is sort of this tool of working class radicalism. What is it that leads to this point where you have thousands of police officers going on strike while the war is still going on? What were the concerns and how were they addressed?
Well, they must have been absolutely desperate, because they could see, they knew that their role was important. And it was only the Metropolitan Police that went out on strike, but there were thousands of them, you know, based all over London in different police stations. And it wasn't until they didn't turn up for work that the superintendents and people in the police stations realized that there was anything wrong. And you saw the telegrams going from one police station to another. Our policemen haven't turned up, of yours? Well, no, ours haven't either. And they marched down Whitehall to 10 Downing Street and were met there by Lloyd George. The issue was that they had been poorly paid for months, if not years. And because of the increasing food prices, they were really, some of them were said to be paid no more than slips of girls or van boys. And they felt completely demoralized by it all. And were just, you know, the final straw had come when they weren't prepared to put up with it any longer. And continuing questions in the House of Commons said, oh, yes, we're looking at it. We're investigating it. There will be a rise soon. But nothing ever happened. And when the police, strikers arrived at Downing Street, they were met by Lloyd George, the Prime Minister, who immediately gave them a pay rise. Because, you know, who else was going to be responsible for keeping law and order and keeping the public safe? But unfortunately, what this did, Lloyd George said, I've been telling the chief constable, the commissioner of police for ages, that the police should have a rise, and he hasn't passed it on. Well, of course, this made the commissioner of police role untenable. I mean, he'd been in post for at least since the beginning of the war. I'm not quite sure of hand when he first took up post, but it was throughout the war. And he found his post was untenable, and so he had to resign, which was an absolute tragedy. But, you know, the police did get their pay rise. And all was, you know, they were back at work within a couple of days. But it was very dramatic.
We've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
What I'm working on now?
Yes.
Did you say? Yes.
Yes.
Well, I'm working on this area of police as ploughmen.
it is
absolutely fascinating.
Is that an article or a book you're looking at?
Well, I'm writing another book eventually. I've got a small grant from the Police History Society to do this. And what I'm looking at was what actually propelled each local authority to release their policemen, because some did and some didn't. And what I want to know is, why did those that released their policemen actually do so? And I've come across things like the potato shortage in Glasgow actually led to a riot in the main square. And the corporation wouldn't allow the women's deputation to go in and put their case. And the provost was heard to say that the women would be better off going home and looking after their babies rather than demonstrating. So the women were utterly furious. And of course, this occupied huge column inches in the newspapers. So to try and mitigate this, I think it was probably because of this, the provost agreed to release the policemen so that the potato shortage at least would, you know, the policemen were seen to be trying to provide food for the whole of the population, not just the working classes. But when you think that the working classes in those days were relying, their main diet was bread and potatoes and pea, you know, take away potatoes and, you know, there were no potatoes. They were really in fear of starvation. So this was an absolute crisis at this point. And, you know, it came up against the working classes accusing the provost of being a ship owner. And the inquiries that were taking place at the time about labour unrest actually showed the difference between the working classes and the upper classes, who were said to be profiteering from the war. And of course, this infuriated the working classes, who felt that their cases were not being heard. So that's the story, I think, behind Glasgow. And in other places, there are other stories about why they released their policemen. But it's a fascinating area.
It does sound fascinating. I hope that when that book comes out, we can have you back on the New Books Network to discuss it.
Thanks, I'd love to.
Okay. Mary Fraser, thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
It's been a delight. Thank you very much.